So I'm Jeff. I'm pitch hitting. We have some first-time guests. I just want you to know, don't evaluate our preaching based on this interaction today. The regular at-bat is gone. We've been going through the book of Genesis, and I love the stuff Justin's been teaching us, some Hebrew words. I was always averse to any other language. I told him in seminary, I'm not learning Hebrew, but he's introduced some good stuff. You know, what are some of that? We got Ra, and we got Tov, and a bunch more. That's how good I am. And what? Yeah. And so I want to review, but I'm going to review differently than he did. And the reason is he made a statement last week that really bothered me. And not in a bad way, in a good way. He made a statement that his generation and those younger than him are rapidly deconstructing their faith, and that the church has some responsibility in that. So I went home and I started thinking about that, and then as I started reading this, that came to my mind. And so I don't want to review what we've already learned. I want to review the importance of Genesis. I think it would be perhaps an understatement to say that our children, as they leave our purview and as we send them out in the world, their faith's going to be challenged, okay? Now, the creation account is pretty critical for their spiritual formation going forward. If you deconstruct the Genesis account, you deconstruct a lot. And some of our basic teachings at Soma is identity. Who am I? We ask that question from a young age. We go into junior high. Am I a skater? Am I a scholar? Am I a musician? Am I an artist? Who do I belong to? Who will love me? That's identity. And then it extends to adults. And we're challenged with our roles. Sometimes our identity is what I do for a living or who I belong to. And God, we've always taught that identity is critical because God says, I want to answer that question. And my answer is way better. And it starts in Genesis 1 where God says, let us make man in our image. That's just one example of how foundational Genesis is for our children. And so my encouragement and my hope is that the review would buttress your conviction, grandparents and parents, that our little ones would be firmly grounded in the creation account and the teachings that we're going through. Now, the way that Mackie, who from the Bible Project, has been teaching this is kind of another level, and I like it. So you're going to have to translate it down for your kids and grandkids. And the beauty is if you can get them to ask questions, you're teaching. You're creating curiosity, and that's what you want to do. Also, when we think about how important the image of God is God, because everyone is made in God's image, that pretty much gets a foundation of how we treat other people. I mean, our culture is fighting over DEI stuff, and God kind of lays it out right there. Everyone's made in my image. We should treat them accordingly. Okay? As they leave or as they go out in the world, they're not going to hear a biblical narrative anywhere. I don't know what's taught in public schools. I doubt it's creation. I know in higher education, that's where the challenge comes from, right? Where one's faith is really challenged. And I think we can, as I think, what could we have done differently in the past, or what can we do differently going forward? It would be to establish that foundation in our children. The competing thought, of course, is evolution. And evolution is not science, in my opinion. It's a religion. Now, scientists study it, but in my opinion, and borrowing a quote from Tim Keller, it takes more faith to believe in evolution than it does in intelligent design, that we're created by God. And I couldn't resist just throwing out one little thing for you, because this is kind of what I focus my studies on in school. And so I just wanted to give you a quick and dirty defense or objection to the theory of evolution. And that is, if you believe in evolution, you got to believe in six evolutions, okay? You have to believe in cosmic evolution, that time, matter, and space somehow came into existence accidentally. You have to believe in chemical evolution, that from hydrogen, 92 elements somehow came into existence. You have to believe in stellar evolution, that stars formed. We've never seen it. You have to believe in organic evolution, that life arises from non-living matter. You have to believe in macroevolution, that one species evolved into another, you know, and microevolution. From the beginning of life, a tree came, a man came, a whale came, and a giraffe came, and all that. Now, Darwin himself said, the biggest objection to my theory would be if we didn't find a fossil account of intermediate species, which we never have. Now, I love this stuff. I could just bore you with tons of this. But I just want to give you one little thing that you could help your kids with that would buttress their belief. For the fun of it, if it's helpful, this morning I wrote a little children's catechism. And if it starts, and we're watching three of our grandsons, so I sat them down and I asked them, who made you? Why did God make you? How do you love God? Who is Jesus? Why did Jesus die on the cross? I asked them all these questions. They got about half of them right. I was really impressed. So if you like one of these, you're welcome to have it. It could be improved on, no doubt. I want to give you a quick thing that Mackie said in the... Justin gave me some material to review from the Bible Project, and here's something that he offered in this week's piece that I thought was helpful. There's kind of three ways people read the Bible. There's... Kelly said this first one is her. She was raised in a Christian home, and it was just pounded into her head that the Bible's true. So when she read the Bible, whatever it said, she believed. I read it, I believe it, God said it, I believe it, that settles it, that's it. That's one way to read the Bible. The other way is more like me. So I read the Bible, and then I look at my experience of life and what I've learned in other circles, and I try to make those fit together, okay? And so the question would be, how did a person live 600 years, or Methuselah 800 years? Or do we have any archaeological evidence of a flood? Those kinds of questions to fit together into God's truth. Now, what Mackie is doing is, and what Justin has led us with, and he's told us this, I just want to say it again, his question is, what did the original readers understand? Because that, we know that the writers wrote to at least to them and to for us. And so that is a way deeper way of looking at this. And that's how all these connections are made that Justin has brought to us. And I think he's done an amazing job. I'm so thankful for that. So here we are. We're in Genesis 8. We just got there. We've seen the effects of sin in the world, okay? And a collision of sin and love. It's the way I would describe it. I think it was, again, Keller who coined the term, the unstoppable force of God's love comes up against the immovable object of the sin of man. And we have this collision that's going to happen over and over and over throughout time. And we, after the fall, we see... the end point is the intentions of man's heart are wicked continually. That is right before what we're about to read. And I was trying to think, how did God feel? Because it says he was grieved, but that term means, it talks about pain. What's going on in God's heart is pain. And that helped me really understand the flood way better. I just thought he got ticked off and said, I'm starting over. But his heart is grieved, and it would be like you raise a child, and it's time to hand them the keys to the car and let them go on their first solo run, and you say, whatever you do, do not text and drive. That's all I ask. I know you put your seatbelt on. I know you'll go the speed limit. I know you'll obey traffic laws, but whatever you do, don't text and drive. And maybe not the first day, but eventually that's exactly what happens, and a crash ensues. And not only is your child injured, but other people are too. Your heart would be broken as a parent to watch that happen. And that's what I think the heart of God is as we get into this. I don't think he takes joy in destroying the earth. It began with the sin began with a woman, then the man, then Cain, then Lamech, then the sons of God, and finally all of humanity is spiraling out of control. And again, every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart were only evil all the time. And so out of his mercy, God intervenes to put an end to this violence, especially violence against humanity. And I believe unchecked sexual sin. And we know that when sin becomes pervasive, we'll see this later in the whole Bible, God acts. Judgment comes. I was trying to explain to my friends in Sierra Leone this picture. They had a country invade them and just brutalize them. And I think it was like that all the time in the days of Noah, to the point it was just unbearable to watch. And so God says, I think the flood is definitely an act of mercy and judgment. So let's read this together. Genesis 8, if you'd pull that up, please. Let's see, how am I going to do this? I'll read it. Well, let's stand and read it. Okay, here's how this is going to go. We've got all of chapter 8. We're going to read that now. We're going to sit down. We're going to talk about it. Then we've got half of chapter 9. We're going to stand back up. We're going to read that, and we're going to sit down. That's what I was given. I'm sorry. Okay, here we go. But God remembered Noah. Let's read together. And all the beasts and all the livestock that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind blow over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were closed, and the rain from the heavens was restrained. And the waters receded from the earth continually. At the end of 150 days, the water had abated. And in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. And the waters continued to abate until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. At the end of 40 days, Noah opened the window of the ark that he had made and sent forth a raven. It went to and fro until the waters were dried up from the earth. Then he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters had subsided from the face of the ground. But the dove found no place to set her foot, and she returned to him to the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. So he put out his hand and took her and brought her into the ark with him. And he waited another 7 days, and again he sent forth the dove out of the ark. And the dove came back to him in the evening, and behold, in her mouth was a fleshy plucked olive leaf. So Noah knew that the waters had subsided from the earth, and then he waited another 7 days and sent forth the dove, and she did not return to him anymore. In the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, the waters were dried off from the earth, and Noah removed the covering from the ark and looked, and behold, the face of the ground was dry. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth had dried out. Then God said to Noah, go out from the ark, you and your wife and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing that is with you, all of the flesh, birds, and animals, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife, and his sons with him. Every beast, every creeping thing, and every bird, everything that moves on the earth, went out by families from the ark. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took some of every clean animal and some of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And when the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma, the Lord said in his heart, I will never curse the ground, for the intentions of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I ever strike down every living creature as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, night and day shall not cease. Have a seat. A lot there. So I meant to tell you before you read that, think it through and what questions come to your mind when you see this text. Okay, I'm asking you now. Open question. What comes to your mind when you, what questions come up, Karen? Yeah, why all the detail? Okay. What else do you see? What makes you curious? If you were a kid, what would you be asking your parents? I'm sorry? How come he couldn't see? Okay. Yeah, what calendar are we talking about? We don't know. It kind of sounds like it started when Noah was born, because it's the 600th day of his life he entered, and 601 he comes out. Okay, good question. What else? Nobody's coming up with my question. Uh-huh. And extras of clean animals for sacrifice. He brought extras of clean animals for worship and sacrifice, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. Great question. How deep was the water? We'll kind of get to that. How deep were the waves? Yeah, one thing I noticed when we read this account, it seems to me like, and I don't know if this is true throughout the Bible, but it's very much understated, especially the violence of the flood. I mean, the words just don't do it justice of what went down. It's way bigger than the words give us a picture of. So great observation. Thanks, Dimitri. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah, where do they go? Great question. Well, the raven found out. Yeah, so we see this remarkable precision in the documentation of time. 7 days to load the ark, 40 days of rain, 150 days on the water, 70 days for the waters to recede, if my math is correct. 40 days after that, Noah sends out the raven. 7 days later, the dove goes out. 7 days later, the dove goes out again. 7 days later, the dove goes out again. 57 more days before God instructed him to leave the ark. Somehow in my head, I didn't think it was about 100 days in that ark, but it was. And I love this precision. For some reason, the author wants us to know that. And for me, I assume when he says 7 days, it's 7 days. And it gives me kind of strength to think a day in creation is a day in creation. Morning and night and one day passed. That's the way the writers wrote it. Here we see all this precision of time. So he sends out the raven to check on death. Raven is a scavenger bird. It's not a clean animal. So he sends the raven out to see what's out there. Well, the raven doesn't even say the raven came back. He found, evidently, now this is a matter of time, so it would be reasonable to believe there's dead stuff floating on the water, okay? And then he uses the he uses a nesting bird, the dove, to test. Now, the first question I would ask is, where does the olive leaf come from? Well, some say that olive trees are really hardy. They can live underwater. Was it salt water? Was it fresh water? Kind of sounds like it was fresh water. And an olive tree probably could live underwater for that amount of time. Or in 100 days, maybe it sprouted. I don't know. But that's a question I have. That's my mind trying to square up stuff. And to here's what I see what's interesting about Noah is he waited. So after he knows there's dry ground, he waits another, again, if I do the math right, about 57 days before God says go. Now, prior to that, we see Adam and Eve taking. Cain takes. I want it now, I want it, and I want it now. Noah's the first guy we see in the story that waits. And how honoring is it to God when, I mean, God obviously knows he wants to get out of there. And I'm sure his family is saying, hey, when we go on vacation, this is getting old. Noah waits. He waits. And I think it honors God. Scripture tells us that the water came from both above and below. You know, there's lots of cultures that have flood narratives. Genesis account is unique. And I'd like to present to you one theory of how it could have gone down. So prior to the flood, the earth has a canopy on it of moisture, kind of like the Northwest, but much thicker. That's preventing ultraviolet light from coming through. That allows people to live hundreds of years. And dinosaurs grow from little lizards to big ones. They just keep growing, okay? Plant life is robust, and perhaps there's no polar ice caps. That's why we find mammoths, fossils up in the Arctic, okay? So a whole different world. Perhaps very flat. Perhaps one continent. And then the waters, underground waters burst forth. The windows of heaven open. And so all the moisture that's in this canopy, God, this is the cosmic collapse that Justin referred to last week. The cosmic collapse of everything coming down, and God is reordering his world. Now, here's a thought-provoking possibility if you bring up Psalm 104. It says, at your command, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, it hurried away. Mountains rose and valleys sank to the levels you decreed. Now, most people would attribute that to the second day of creation. But there's a pretty good case in a long paper I read that was very detailed that perhaps this is happening at late flood. God is pushing the mountains up and he's pushing the valleys down and the continents are coming into movement and the places. And then we have the polar ice caps. And it says the wind, God brought the wind. So we have the beginning of hydrology as we see it. You know what? Clouds come in, dump the rain. Rain goes down, it's evaporated in the oceans. The whole cycle of water begins to. And this would account for things such as limestone found on the top of mountains. Limestone is made by degraded marine organisms, shells, and coral. We find it on the top of mountains. How is that possible? Well, if God pushed the mountains up during the flood, it certainly works. There's fish fossils at 18,000 feet. That would account for that, okay? Now, what's interesting is almost all scientists that I've read, I mean, referred to, believe in a cataclysmic event, one or two in the world. They call it the period of great dying. Oh, by the way, just a disclaimer, I want to say I got a bunch of stuff from Mackie, MacArthur, Hovland, just so you know, I didn't, this is all from those guys, okay? You know, I don't want to plagiarize anybody. So, scientists agree there was at least one cataclysmic event, mainly two, and they would believe it's 550 million years ago, and it was done by a meteor. The second one was probably volcanic. Okay, well, volcanic activity, we see that. We see rocks from Mount Rainier in Canada. Okay, we know the volcanic activity over time changed greatly. Okay, so that's we see, but we don't see the fossil evidence. So Noah sends out his raven and then the dove. And then what does he do? What's the first thing Noah does when he comes off the ark? He worships. You think, what are the other things he could have done? Explore, build something. First thing Noah does is he worships. Now, the landscape of what they're looking at could have been completely different. And I suspect that the people that come off the ark, his children and wives, realize God has done an amazing work. So who knows what awe is inside of them, but what they choose to do is stop and worship. Now the question that should come to your mind is, why is God pleased with the smell of a burnt animal? That came in my head. Well, barbecue does smell good to us. Does he love the smell of dead animals? And I think in today's world, we have to answer that question. Psalm 51:16, "For you will not delight in sacrifice, or I would give it," the psalmist says. "You will not be pleased with the burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. O God, you will not despise." That's what they worshiped with. His family came with a heart that said, "God, wow, and we're here, and we're thankful." And I'm sure they were scared. And their first act isn't to gather food or clean out the ark or whatever they could have done. They worship. Noah's sacrifice is a foreshadowing of the sacrifice of Christ. Now, last week, how he landed the plane, as I heard him say, was that the ark is like God for us, meaning like, or the ark is like Christ, and that he saves us. As they were saved in the ark, Christ saves us. And as we get on the ark, we can extend that saving grace to others, that we can be the ark for others to invite them into a relationship with God. Okay? That's pretty good. I like that. But what we see here with Noah is a foreshadowing of the permanent sacrifice that Christ is going to make for us. Which leads us now to chapter 9. Any questions about anything? Did I hit? What was your question? Oh, well, Jacques Cousteau says, if you flattened out the whole earth, pushed up the valleys, pushed down the mountains, and the amount of water on the earth, we'd all be under 10,000 feet of water. Now, how he comes up with that, I don't know, but I read it. It's fascinating, though, how God has ordered his world. Was there any other questions that we didn't hit to? I thought they were all pretty good. Okay, can we look at chapter 9? We're going to go to verse 17. Let's stand again. Read his word together. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth and upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I gave you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And for your lifeblood, I will require a reckoning. From every beast, I will require it, and from man. From his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of a man. Of man. I can't see that. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man his blood shall be shed, for God made man in his own image. And you, be fruitful and multiply, increase greatly on the earth and multiply in it. Then God said to Noah and his sons, behold, I establish my covenant with you and your offspring after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the livestock, and every beast on the earth, and many as came out of the ark, for it is for every beast of the earth. I establish my covenant with you that never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood, and never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant that I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all future generations. I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth. When I bring clouds over the earth, and the bow is seen in the clouds, I will remember my covenant that is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And said, God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant that I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Have a seat. Okay, again, what do you see? What questions come up? What do you observe in the text? That was fast, I know. For you visual learners, you got to see it. For you other learners, you got to feel it. Any questions that jump out to you? Zach? We might see that in Revelation, huh? Yeah, I always thought God kind of has his fingers behind his back saying, I'm not going to flood anymore, but there's other stuff coming. Yeah. He mentioned fish. Every living creature. I assumed the fish were good in the flood. That's a great question. And that leads you to the argument of a local flood, which creates all kinds of trouble in the world of people that think this stuff. I mean, it's big. And there's other stuff, that's a great question. Anybody else? I'm sorry? Oh, he asked, what about people that landed on other continents? Yeah, good question. Not sure I'm going to answer that one. Anything else? It's good to have questions. Great question. Great question. Oh yeah, we know what that is. Or whoa, seven. What do we know about seven? The number seven. Perfect number. How many colors in a rainbow? Seven. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's a spectrum. What else do you see? You see anything repeated from the start of man in Genesis 1 to this start? Be fruitful and multiply says it twice in this text, and we've seen that before. It's kind of, I have mixed feelings about that. It's kind of like, he has to say it again to us. Just tell us again, because we have to start over. But it's important, he says it twice. Be fruitful and multiply. Well, that's interesting because he's going to make some changes to humanity on this pass. Okay, and we just read it. What were some of those changes? Yeah, I'm going to give you, before I gave you plants to eat, now I'm giving you, you can eat meat. Great question on why. It could be man is just bent on killing things. Well, if you're going to kill something, kill an animal and eat it. Okay? But for some reason, he's opened that up. And now he's made animals afraid of man. I think before, animals and mankind were, it wasn't like it is today. But it clearly says, I'm going to make them fearful of you, which is rightly so, because you're going to want to eat them. Okay, so he built in them a fear of us. What else is different this go around? Conflict? Consequences. So we see from the life, if a man's life is taken, he requires man to take his life. Wow. Why would he do that? Well, great question. I think the idea of now we can be meat eaters, and so for you meat eaters, I think we can see that there isn't really a moral high ground to not eating meat, okay? It might be healthier, you can make that argument, but God gives us the green light to eat meat. But he makes this condition, I don't want you to eat it with the lifeblood in it. So there's two things that could come from that. One is, as we see later in the Levitical law, he's trying to protect us from normal diseases. Blood carries disease. And he's protecting us. Okay, he's saying prepare it correctly. And the other thing is symbolically, he's going, look, all life belongs to me, not you. I'm going to let you borrow the life for your sustenance, but it belongs to me. Life is in the blood. You can't have the blood. Again, symbolically. Now, that makes kind of good sense to me. And, of course, the animal world has brought up all kinds of issues for us, right? So we have PETA, the people for the ethical treatment of animals, right? That's a good thing. We should treat animals ethically, okay? But they're not on the same playing field as man, okay? People and animals are different, according to God. Doesn't mean we get to mistreat them, but he's provided them for us. And then we see the value of life and justice. We see God introducing laws, and we see capital punishment. So is God, now there's, I don't think you could take this and say, okay, God greenlights capital punishment necessarily. There's a lot in the Bible about this. But what I think is happening is God is saying, look, you guys are bent on killing each other, and I want to put an end to it. And I'm going to create a deterrent. I want to protect man. And so if you take the life of the man, I'm going to take your life. Now, in Levitical law, they get into all kinds of nuances of how that could happen. Is it an accident? Is it premeditated? Is it? There's all kinds of other things. But generally, I think the writers are trying to show us that God is trying to intervene in our ways to protect us. He loves us. And so don't kill each other. And then other things come, as we see later in the Bible. It's hard to realize he's mandating death for a murderer. That's a hard concept for us to understand. But we do know that if a person does commit premeditated murder and his life is required of it, he's not going to do it again. And depending on how that is carried out civilly, it is a deterrent to others. So that's what I believe is God, it's an act of love. Before the flood, he didn't enforce this command. So we see Cain killing Abel. God protects him, puts a sign on him, so he's protected. Lamech then commits murder and brags about it, doesn't take him out. And then we see this violence and wickedness that's now pervading all of the culture, and God intervenes. So, perhaps even Jesus reinforced the principle later when he says, he who lives by the sword will die by the sword. But we do know that human life is sacred, and the truth that ultimately points to Christ's blood. It's blood. Without the shedding of blood, there is no remission of sin. And so we see this theme of violence and yet sacrifice and love. Again, the insurmountable force of God's love coming against the immovable object of sin. And as they exit the ark, we see this word covenant. I think it's about seven times in this text. We haven't seen it before. So a covenant is God's deepest promise. For man to man, it would be like a treaty, okay? But it's formal. And in this covenant, it's all on God. There's no responsibility of people to do this. And he makes this covenant with you and I, because it says all the offspring and every living being. So there'll be no more cosmic collapse. God is saying, it's not going to happen. I won't let it happen. Okay? And he's made that covenant with all of us and all living creatures. It's a covenant of love. It's kind of cosmic stability, because you see in the text he says, day and night, cold and heat, harvest and planting. This and what that is that's the structure of the world we know it. He's saying, I'm going to protect that. Now, this covenant, we're going to see covenants throughout the Bible. And these are really significant moments of establishing your understanding of the character of God. Now, prior to this, there are those who would say there were two covenants that happened in Genesis 1. One was called an Adamic covenant, and one was called Edenic covenant. But they're not formalized, and the word isn't used there, and it could be because he didn't need to make it formal because there was no sin. He trusted us. Be fruitful and multiply the earth, right? And then he talks about, as sin came into the world, this is what's going to happen. From the offspring of a woman, you will bruise his heel and he will crush your head. Okay? And so we see these things, but it's not formalized in the word covenant. Later, we're going to see a covenant with Israel, offering life and security. I'm sorry, Abraham first, promising a land and descendants, a covenant with Israel, offering life and security, a covenant with David, promising a ruler out of his line, that's Christ, and then we see the new covenant, one that is fulfilled in Jesus. And he gives us this sign to remember it, this rainbow. Pretty cool. I've seen rainbows that go from one end to the other, double rainbows. We've got pictures. They're fascinating. And he says, that rainbow is going to remind me. Okay? It's going to remind him. Fascinating. Original scriptures call it a bow. I think that's what the text said. It was a bow. It doesn't say rainbow. It says bow. So back in the earliest times, when they did hunt, how do you think they hunted? With a bow, right? Mackie makes a great connection that it's like God. So in mankind, when we want to destroy something, perhaps they used a bow. God takes his bow and puts it on the wall. It's out of commission. I'm not going to use it again. I'm not going to use my destructive force on this world again. And I'm going to put it up there for you to see of all time. Could you bring up that quote? These are two German theologians that Mackie quoted, and I tried to pull this off his material, Kiel and Delitzsch. And they write, "Shining upon a dark background, it represents the victory of the light of love over the fiery darkness of wrath. How do bows appear in the clouds? They originate from the effect of the sun on a dark cloud. It typifies the willingness of the heavenly to penetrate the earthly. Stretched out or stretched between heaven and earth, rainbows bridge heaven and earth as a bond of peace between both heaven and earth and spanning the horizon. It points to the all-embracing universality of the divine mercy." Now, I don't know what you think of when you see a rainbow in the sky. I hope that perhaps as you view those in the future that you'll look again and remember that that's a covenant with you. God made a covenant with you. So in the text, what can we pull out? What did we learn about God in this text? Anybody? Anybody? Mm-hmm. He's faithful. He keeps his promises. He's for us. Yeah. Yeah, he keeps reaching down, intervening in this world, and motivated by love. Okay? We're going to see it later in the new covenant. But he redeems broken things over and over again, right? We mess them up, and he redeems them. So even in the sake in this story where it's a cosmic collapse, and he starts over, he's proven to us that he is the God of new beginnings, and we see it throughout the text, throughout the rest of the Bible. He starts over with Israel over and over and over again, David. Even the disciples, even the time of Jesus, you see that God fixes broken things. I mean, look at the story of Saul. I was talking to a friend the other day about Saul. You know, here he is, Saul before Paul, and he is killing Christians. He is the number one enemy of Christians in the whole world. God takes him and makes him the preeminent voice in the New Testament. That is the God of new beginnings. And he can do it with Paul. He can do it with all humanity. He can certainly do it with us. Jesus said, "Come to me, all who are weary, and I'll give you rest." This is the new covenant. The final covenant. The one sealed by Christ. The one that we can't uphold on his own. These covenants that I told you about, God bats 1,000. He was faithful in every one of them. Mankind was faithful in 0. We come to the new covenant, and I've said this before, but God is saying, look, I'll keep my side of the covenant. I'll be your God. And he calls us to live without sin, which we failed. And now he says, I'm going to keep my side of the deal and yours. I will come to this earth. I will live a perfect life for you, and I'll offer it to you, and I'm inviting you to be with me. That's our method of how we're going to remedy this sin. Sin separates us from God. He's a holy God. He always does what's good, right, and perfect. Sin, he doesn't allow sin in his presence. So how does he cleanse us? He cleanses us with blood, with the blood of his own blood. The new covenant promises forgiveness of sin, a heart transformation by the Holy Spirit, a personal relationship with God, and it includes everyone. You know, you think about a party that you don't get invited to, how it hurts when everybody's invited and you're not. This party we're all invited to. You've got your invitation. So as we approach communion, we'll dim the lights. I just want you to remember this promise, the promise of the rainbow, and then the new covenant, that God has come for us. He's offered us his own life. And if that's what you believe, if you've never believed that, I would ask you to consider it today. If you've believed it before, believe it again. Confess it to God. So what we do is, for those of you who don't know, this is communion. You don't have to be a member here to have communion. If this is what you believe, you're welcome to have it. And so what we do is we take the bread, tear it off, we dip it either in juice or wine, whatever you want, and then step aside and either by yourself or with a group of two or three, one of you can pray, and that's kind of how we do communion here, okay? And so after a bit of a time, then we'll sing a couple songs and we'll be done. So, Father, thank you for my friends. God, thank you for your word that's so rich. I mean, deeper. And God, thank you for showing me a deeper and deeper understanding. God, help us to know that the more that we search your word, the more we get, the more we're fed, the more we're encouraged. And God, make us love your word. I pray that we would build that in our children, and so that in the future they stand strong in their faith. God, we pray for our time together. We thank you, God, this new covenant, the first covenant of the rainbow, and this covenant that we would that you've made a way for us through Jesus. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.